Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Thanks for tuning in. Should be a good one for you. Got lots of news to cover. Ukraine, but also Iran and Syria, if I can get to them. I don't know. You know how time flies and everything. But also, an extremely important thing happened that doesn't seem to have gotten that much attention. Anyway. Maybe I just missed it, but, we'll be talking with, I'll be interviewing Ashley Gorski from the ACLU's National Security Project about this recent court decision, which I admit I haven't read the court decision, but I read about it. I know of it. And, I read a great Nat Hentoff article about it. I thought I'd better get a real lawyer on to talk about exactly what this means. But what it is, remember Mayor Bloomberg and his NYPD spying way outside of the law and their jurisdiction and everything else, spying on Muslims, as reported by the Associated Press. Apuzzo and I forgot the other guy. They did really good work on that. Anyway. There was a lawsuit about it, and the judge said, nah, government can do whatever they want to, especially if you're Muslim, basically. Well, so that's why I need a lawyer on to explain. And there's a couple of things about that. But anyway, I'm going to wait. But just so you know, and that's a real important thing. And maybe, see, I don't know. I assume that everybody's not a bigot, because what, are you going to be a bigot about stuff, or what? You know, people? If you hate anybody, hate power. Not just, you know, people, but... Maybe if you say, yes, spying on Muslims, maybe people who aren't Muslims just shrug. That us and them, we, they kind of thing can be powerful, depending on where you draw your line. So just change it around. Oh yeah, NYPD, infiltrating synagogues everywhere, spying on all the rabbis and all their students. That might could be problematic. Or if they were doing that to, say, I don't know, the Lutherans. Well, you know, we're just looking for terrorists. Or how about Irish Catholics? Yeah, we'll just infiltrate all the Catholic churches, as many as we want. Because, you know, maybe some of Representative Peter King's allies are still funding the IRA, which I guess doesn't set off bombs anymore anyway, but who cares? So, anyway, take your favorite protected ethnic group and put them in place of the Muslims in this case. Not that that's an ethnic group, it's a religious belief. Anyway, you god dang darn know what the hell I mean. It's huge what the court has done here, saying that these guys can get away with it. So anyway, to make a long story medium length, the ACLU will be on in a while to discuss it. Good deal. Then Brendan O'Neill from Spiked Online will be on to talk about Ukraine and specifically Western intervention in Ukraine. Also, I have things to say about Western intervention in Ukraine. Starting with Western intervention in Ukraine began before last weekend. You may well be aware of that. We've talked about it on the show. I admit I haven't covered it as well as I should have been covering it over these past few months. Seeing at how badly this whole thing blew up. But this is basically another, I would say, clumsier version of the color-coded revolution. This is a Western, American, and European-backed coup d'etat putsch against a democratically elected leader who everyone is quick to say was a piece of garbage. Yeah, he was a politician. Oh, did you hear he built a big palace for himself? Yeah, like the White House. Yeah, what a thief. He's just like an American, you know, U.S. government, national politician, huh? I hate him already. That doesn't give the Americans the right to have them overthrown. And everybody's saying, yeah, but the people in the street were the people in the street. They're making a great point, but the people in the street weren't the ones who overthrew them. The ones who overthrew them were the Americans and the Europeans who were threatening to put sanctions on all the billionaires' wealth that happened to be out of the country. You better get rid of this guy. We're going to lock up all your funds, they said to, what's his name, and the other guy. I got the articles here. It's Yanukovych's fall, the power of Ukraine's billionaires, in Der Spiegel, spiegel.de. And let's see, on page 2, I think, is where they really get to the point about the sanctions here. See if I can provide a quote for you. Yanukovych's fall, the power of Ukraine's billionaires, is the article. And now I am scanning for the word sanctions. Let me hire the computer to help me with that. Nice. That's how Akhmatov and Firtash built up options for a possible future without Yanukovych. When the protests broke out on Independence Square in November, both oligarchs saw how obstinately Yanukovych reacted. They began to distance themselves. It was clear to both of them that if worse came to worst and the West imposed sanctions on Ukraine, their businesses would be the first to be affected. And then, yeah, that's not the quote I was looking for, actually. Anyway, it's in there. And, of course, that was all that's going on is the musical chairs of the oligarchs. They call this a revolution, like the people overthrew the power over there. When, no, just one faction overthrew the other. Oh, and they all happen to be traitors to foreign powers. And maybe that's true on both sides. I don't mean all the people, but I mean all the ones with the power. They're either working as sock puppets for the West or for the Russians, basically. And, you know, I got an email today, I guess this is going around on the talk radio and all that, about the memorandum. Oh, man, don't let me lose my link that has the memorandum that said that the Budapest memorandum signed by Bill Clinton, John Major, Boris Yeltsin, and Leonid Kuchma. That says that, hey, we all promise to respect the independence and sovereignty of the existing borders of Ukraine. I guess the we can coup d'etat and regime change their government without trying to change the borders is supposedly their loophole there or whatever. But this is being portrayed as though America has a defense pact with Ukraine and that we are sworn to protect them, when really all we're sworn to do is to leave them alone. You can read about it in the Telegraph, and they have a link there to the Budapest Memorandum. That explains how it works. And so, you know, the question I got, a friend forwarded me an email. The question I got was the red herring based off the lie. Well, since America's, which in the guy in the question allowed for the possibility that maybe he'd heard this wrong somewhere, maybe on Hannity's show or something. But he said, well, geez, aren't we bound to protect their borders from attack from anybody, the Russians or anybody else? And if we don't live up to our treaty obligation, then won't that be the worst thing in the whole world? And so, of course, the answer is no, we don't have a treaty like that with them whatsoever. And let's change the stakes. What if Russia invaded all the Baltic states? You willing to get in a nuclear war with Russia? Or, I'm sorry you live in a Baltic state. You should have got a visa and got the hell out of there somewhere further away from Russia, whose army is bigger than yours and who may reinvade you at some point. I don't know. Sorry, but I'm not willing to give Austin, Texas. I'm not willing to give any American city like it's up to me. But, you know, which American cities would you trade? And Cold War is over. 25 years ago, over. At least from the Soviet Union's angle. And they got this whole right-wing narrative about the re-rise of the Soviet Union under the form of Putin's proposed Eurasian Union, which no one else really wants to go along with. Everybody's scared of that guy, but not so scared of him that they'll do exactly what he says. And, you know, Russia is not even a shadow. It's like a shadow in a very bright room lit from all angles, kind of a can't even find the shadow of its former self of the USSR. And it's not going to, you know, reenact World War II, basically, in order to reconquer Eastern Europe and all of this. The best they're trying to do is just EU-style, you know, screw everyone into it, but not march on them. But anyway, it's the Americans who have continued the Cold War this whole time. In fact, it's in Robert Gates' new book that Dick Cheney, after the fall of the Soviet Union, wanted to go ahead and completely dismantle Russia, too, as best we could. Everything we could do to tear Russia apart so that we can have our benevolent global hegemony and no one can stand in our way. And they encircled Germany, too, on the way to Russia. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first-ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., natsummit.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Again, ACLU coming up in just a minute about your freedom of religion here in the United States. Hey, what the hell? We gave up the Second Amendment. We gave up the Fourth Amendment. We gave up the Fifth Amendment. We gave up the Sixth Amendment. We gave up the Eighth Amendment. We never even had the Ninth and Tenth Amendment. So why the hell should you be able to choose what church to go to? Or why should you be able to go to church in peace and not have the government come and molest you? You know, before your priest can get to it. It was too obvious, wasn't it? That was why it took so long to say. I wasn't sure if I was even going to follow through and go ahead with it, but I did. Anyway, Mirko in the chat room points out that, Victoria Nuland, the Deputy Assistant Secretary or Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, that means basically the liaison, the State Department liaison to the European Union, she's caught out on the telephone with Jeffrey Pyatt, the ambassador to Ukraine, just 3 weeks back, plotting regime change. And the whole thing is about 4 minutes long. You can find it on YouTube. I'm going to go ahead and play a couple minutes of it just to give you, you know, a little bit, and we'll review what's here, but anyway, it's worth hearing if you hadn't heard it before.
The Klitschko piece is obviously the complicated electron here, especially the announcement of him as deputy prime minister. And you've seen some of my notes on the troubles in the marriage right now, so we're trying to get a read really fast on where he is on this stuff. But I think your argument to him, which you'll need to make, I think that's the next phone call we want to set up, is exactly the one you made to Yachts. And I'm glad you sort of put him on the spot on where he fits in this scenario. And I'm very glad he said what he said in response.
Yeah, there you go. And Yats, of course, is, when they talk about Yats, I like how they have nicknames for all of these guys. That's Arseny Yatsenyuk, who is, ta-da, the new prime minister of Ukraine, somehow.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tawny Book on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know. I just think Cleach going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay, good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
All right, now you're not off the hook yet. I want to let you off the hook, but wait.
I can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, that when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Seri. Did I write you that this morning?
Yeah, okay. I saw that.
He's now gotten both Seri and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Seri could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it.
Mm. Scandal, scandal. Diplomat uses F-word. How not very diplomatic of her. But what was the context? The context was the Europeans, we sort of subcontracted this regime change to them, and they're not getting the job done. And so screw them. I was talking to Ban Ki-moon, and he's going to get me, oh, what's his name, and we're going to go in there, and he's going to glue this dang thing together. We're tired of waiting around. And then next is, we'll have Joe call, and he'll make sure. This is the last clip, I swear.
So on that piece, Jeff, when I wrote the note, Sullivan's come back to me, VFR, saying, you need Biden, and I said, probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
Okay, great.
All right.
Thanks.
All right, so the point here is not that the Russians are justified in invading Crimea, although you might notice that not a shot was fired. The point here is that history didn't begin on Saturday. History began, what, 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, or maybe even last year, or maybe back, you know, I don't know, 300,000 years ago, something like that. I don't know when. 1991? How about 1991? How about 1914? But anyway, there is history happened back before the other day. That's all I'm trying to point out. And in this case, the Americans were intervening. And I don't know if anybody heard, maybe some of you heard my interview of Ray McGovern over the weekend for KPFK, which actually is going to end up airing tomorrow. On the air there, because I was preempted by the fund drive, unfortunately. But it's on my website. And Ray is saying, hey, look, you know, this was a bridge too far, and they should have known. Come on. These neocons, and this is what, and it was hard for me to accept, too, that America, and therefore the world, is ruled by a bunch of people who are ridiculous, incompetent boobs. And Robert Kagan is an idiot. And his stupid wife is stupid, too. And what do these people think that they can do? And you know what, man? I should have got the clip. Oh, you know what? Somebody tweeted me the dang clip. I'm going to find you the clip. Because it was on The Daily Show. How much time do I have? Man, is it worth it? You know what? Go to my Twitter page. Twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. And I retweeted it yesterday or the day before. Somebody sent me the clip. I kept saying it was The Daily Show. But remember, I wasn't sure. It wasn't The Daily Show. It was Colbert. But it wasn't his big interview where he goes over and interviews an author or something. It was his little interview at the desk. And the interview was with this guy from the Council on Foreign Relations, the editor of Foreign Affairs, saying, giggle, 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 we're running off with Ukraine, and those stupid Russians can't stop us, and we're so smart. Yeah, here's the link right here, man. Thank you very much to Daniel for this link, which he tweeted. It's Gideon Rose, and even the still shot is him so proud of himself for getting us into this mess. And I mean, it's really sad, actually, anyway, I'm not going to play the clip, but there it is. It's on my Twitter feed, and the clip is him saying, well, yeah, we had Putin distracted by the Olympics. It was a perfect time to go running off with Ukraine. Well, yeah, except for geography and continental drift takes a long time and that kind of thing, because Ukraine ain't anywhere near North America. And, anyway, so this is what I was telling Alan earlier. This is what Robert Higgs, in the case of World War II, calls truncating the antecedents. In other words, let's not talk about what happened before the giant thing that happened. Let's just talk about that. Let's never really examine how it is that we get ourselves into these messes. And that's exactly what they're doing here. And to watch Christian Amanpour on CNN, I mean, you got to have one hell of a sense of humor, this lady. I could smell her perfume from here. This will not stand, she announced this morning on CNN International. This must not stand. Yeah, what are you going to do about it? For crying out loud. And, you know, for an invasion of Crimea, it's sort of worth mentioning that Crimea has its own parliament, you know, like its own state government within the Ukrainian Union that they sort of have this agreement with. And they have their own parliament. And their prime minister, I don't know if they held a vote or not, but their prime minister asked Putin to intervene. The head of their navy went ahead and defected to the Russian side. So these lines are not all clear cut. The Americans are acting like, as long as territorial integrity run by our sock puppets in Kiev is advantageous to our side, then territorial integrity is absolutely sacrosanct. But, you know, if they want to split South Sudan off from the rest of Sudan, you know, that's where the oil is, got to keep the Chinese out and all of that, give the army something to do down there, then that's perfectly fine. There's no sovereignty in Sudan that America's bound to respect any more than in Kosovo or any other place where I'm trying to think of more places. America supports secession all the time. We at least, the U.S. Empire at least created a de facto tripartite secession in Iraq. I mean, there is no real Iraqi state anymore. There's Southern Arab Shiistan from Baghdad to Basra, and then there's Anbar to the west and sort of northwest, and then there's Kurdistan up in the far north. And I guess there's still a war over Tikrit to be fought, or over Kirkuk, I mean, waiting to be fought, but more or less we have a de facto secession there. Nothing sacred about these borders at all, depending on which side the American government's on. And, anyway, I'm a libertarian. I believe in secession to the last man anyway. How could anyone in any city, whether Kiev or whatever the hell, I forgot how to pronounce it, Donetsk or whatever in the east, or down in Odessa or whatever, how could anyone in any city, any collection of politicians claim to rule the authority to rule the rest? I mean, you got to believe in this magical popular sovereignty and social contract and all this crap that doesn't hold up to the slightest bit of scrutiny. So it's not like I'm, taking the side of anybody here, but my foremost obligation is opposition to American empire and American meddling. And you see what kind of fights they get us in. And, you know, John McCain, and I ain't no damn partisan Democrat, man. What I hate about McCain the most is that he's so bad he makes me actually prefer the Democrats when it really comes down to who's more likely to start a major war with a major power. The Republicans are just worse. They're deliberately dumber and worse. They're just horrible. God, they're so horrible. And McCain is the leader of them all. And even Rand Paul's statement is all about Russia must do this, that, and the other thing. And no mention whatsoever about how this intervention on their behalf, on their part, is strictly blowback to American intervention in the first place. Sad. If you can't beat them, join them, I guess, huh? Join the worst war party on the planet. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org. Nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest on the show today is Ashley Gorski from the ACLU's National Security Project. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Ashley?
I'm doing well. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing great. I really appreciate you joining us today. And I'm sorry, I'm running way behind here. Are you a lawyer there, or what exactly is your position at the ACLU, please?
Yes, I'm an attorney. I'm the Nadine Strawson Fellow in the National Security Project.
Okay, great. Thanks so much for that clarification. Good to know. Okay, so the NYPD Bloomberg Project of spying on Muslims, even outside of their jurisdiction. I'll let you talk about how far outside the law, but certainly outside the lines of where they're supposed to be operating. I know that, and cooperating with the CIA and all this has culminated in a lawsuit, which has now been dismissed. So we have plenty of time. I'm hoping that, first of all, you could sort of take us through the background of the story and, you know, describe the color of this thing, you know, how far it went and what it is exactly at question here. And then we can talk all about the scandal of this decision by the federal judge in this case.
Sure. So since 2002, the NYPD has engaged in this Muslim surveillance program. And the NYPD has conducted invasive and ineffective surveillance of innocent Muslims in New York City and far beyond New York City. The program violates the First Amendment right to freedom of religion, and it violates the 14th Amendment right to equal protection of the laws. But under this program, the NYPD has engaged in a wide variety of intrusive and ineffective tactics. It's mapped Muslim communities. It's placed cameras outside of mosques to record congregants coming and going. And it has dispatched NYPD officers and informants to infiltrate mosques and Muslim organizations. And it's done all of this without suspicion of wrongdoing.
And now, what is this about the girls' school that they infiltrated there?
Sure. One of the plaintiffs in the New Jersey case involves a girls' school in New Jersey. And that case is being brought by Muslim advocates and the Center for Constitutional Rights. And you know, the NYPD's tactics really know no bounds and are clearly not related to individualized suspicion of wrongdoing. Mm-hmm.
And can you comment on the legality, or first of all, I guess the extent and or the legality of the CIA working with them on this project?
No, I can't comment on the legality of the CIA working with them on this project, but I can say that the architect of much of this project is a man named David Cohen, who's an ex-CIA and who's imported a mode of surveillance and infiltration that, you know, we would say is probably not appropriate for a local law enforcement agency and is heavily inflected by his tenure at the CIA.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, anticipating the counter-argument always, how many September 11th attack style terrorist incidents did they prevent with this surveillance?
Well, the mapping activities of the demographics unit didn't generate a single lead, and there's an NYPD officer who's on the record saying that. In terms of the NYPD's other efforts, you know, ProPublica has done a fantastic job of debunking some of the NYPD's larger, more grandiose claims to have stopped terrorism in New York City. You know, many of those plots actually involved situations in which the NYPD provided the means, it provided the design, it provided the plan, and then it jumps in and says, you know, we thwarted a terrorist plot that the NYPD essentially created. So I'd highly recommend that your listeners check out the ProPublica report on the NYPD's actual records.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's a great footnote there. And there was at least one of these cases I remember where, I mean, that's pretty much sounds like the NYPD copying the FBI, but there was at least one of these where the FBI said, this is such a bad entrapment that we refuse to, or Did I say that right? The FBI refused to help the NYPD, told the NYPD, this is too bad even for us to help entrap this one, and refused to go along.
Yes. Yeah.
Amazing.
That has occurred. Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were going to say the name of the case there. I don't know it.
That name is escaping me at the moment, but you're correct that there have been cases that federal prosecutors have declined to prosecute and that local prosecutors have taken up, and the federal prosecutors declined to prosecute because of the reasons that you just cited.
Right. Okay, now, so talk about this lawsuit. Who exactly was suing here in this one?
Sure. So in the case that was just dismissed by the federal judge in New Jersey, the plaintiffs were business owners, students, and others who identified as Muslim and were targeted on that basis. And the court dismissed the lawsuit on a few different grounds, none of which, in our view, were justified.
Well, okay, can you go through the different grounds? Because it sounds like the kind of thing where, you know, the USA has been around for a while. I thought these sorts of questions were settled about what they can do as far as targeting people based on their religious beliefs and or affiliations.
Sure, I'll go through those grounds now. So first, the court concluded that the plaintiffs hadn't suffered enough harm to bring the lawsuit, but the plaintiffs had clearly suffered business losses. They'd suffered harm to future educational and employment opportunities, and they'd been denied equal treatment under the law. And each of those harms alone is sufficient to allow the plaintiffs to bring suit, and the court just ignored those allegations. The second basis for the court's decision that we disagree with is that the court determined that the plaintiffs' injuries were caused by the Associated Press disclosures and not the NYPD. As you know, the Associated Press, in a Pulitzer Prize-winning expose, has written extensively about the NYPD's discriminatory Muslim surveillance program. And so the court said that those AP disclosures caused plaintiffs harm, but that justifies logic and common sense. And third, the court said that it wasn't plausible that the NYPD discriminated because the purpose of the Muslim surveillance program is to prevent terrorism. But of course, these aren't mutually exclusive. A law enforcement agency can unconstitutionally discriminate while claiming to pursue a legitimate goal.
All right. Now, first of all, I guess the question on all three of those is about, you know, prior court rulings and precedent. When you say that they just the judge decided to just ignore obvious harms, standing providing harms here. Aren't there already decisions, like you're saying, it's established already that if they have at least some claim, then I don't know what level they have to prove it to go forward, but if they have some kind of claim to business harm, right, that's more than hurt feelings or distress or something. If they're claiming that, no, look at my ledger, I'm making less money because of this wrong thing that happened to me, then they can't just ignore that, can they, or can they? Is that a reversible error right there?
In my view, it is. The counsel and Hassan have indicated that they're going to appeal, so we'll see what the Third Circuit has to say about it. But it's very clear from the face of the complaint that the plaintiffs have alleged business harm, and that alone should be enough to provide them with standing to bring the lawsuit.
Yeah, and I mean, never even mind basic. Is this the kind of thing where you don't even get to the First Amendment part of it because there's so many other wrong things going on? Instead of going straight to the argument, or I guess you have to win your standing first, but then isn't the argument that they can't target you for your religious affiliation because that's in direct violation of the first or second clause of the First Amendment right off the bat, right?
Absolutely. It's a violation of the First Amendment, and it's also a violation of the 14th Amendment guarantee of equal protection of the laws. But the court didn't have the opportunity to address those arguments
right,
because it didn't even evaluate the evidence. It just dismissed the complaint out of hand before it had an opportunity to consider those arguments in a deep and meaningful way.
Right. And then I'm sorry for laughing out loud while you were talking about the I was trying to muffle it a little bit about the blame the Associated Press for breaking the story. Now, now, what's the court precedent on that? That if the government is doing something illegal, I don't know if there's a J. Edgar Hoover example or something like that, but Has any court, is he citing any other standing decision that says that the journalists who do the work to discover the illegality or at least some level of wrongdoing, that they are in fact the ones who are causing the harm rather than simply exposing a harm that exists in and of itself? That's just hilarious to me. I don't know. I mean, in a sad way, but.
No, it's really a bizarre ruling on causation. And the case that the court cited to support its conclusion there, in my view, was not directly applicable and pretty easily distinguishable. So the court didn't have a clear basis in law for making that argument.
Can you elaborate about that a little bit more? I'm just interested.
Sure. The court didn't provide extensive citation or information about its causation ruling. If you look at the opinion, it's a very short opinion, and the cases that the court cites to just don't deal precisely with this kind of factual context.
I see. All right, and then on the part where they say it's not discrimination because these are somehow it's a terrorism investigation, is that just completely a non sequitur the way it sounds to me?
It really is. The court in no way considered how the NYPD attempted to prevent terrorism. And here plaintiff's allegations were all about the fact that the NYPD's methods were discriminatory, and the court just didn't engage with that element of plaintiff's allegations at all. It just focused on the fact that the NYPD purported to have the purpose of preventing terrorism.
So tell me, you think at all the bars where the lawyers drink across the country, everybody is just shocked about this. They just can't believe this madness. Am I right? And they're all going to stop it.
I can't purport to speak for all the lawyers in the bars across the country. In my view, it's madness, but it also isn't the first time that we've seen courts be overly deferential in the national security context to the claims of the government.
Right. Well, no, it's certainly not. Very nicely understated there. I always go off pretty loud. All right. Well, I guess, well, let me ask you this in very little time we have left, 45 mm-hmm. seconds or a minute. Just how important is this in the, like you say, there's 1,000 violations like this, but we're sort of outrage fatigued. But I wonder, 1 to 10, just how terribly terrifying of a violation of the First Amendment is this?
I hesitate to ascribe a number to it just because in working with our clients, it's clear that this violation is so profound and so textured and so real that it doesn't do it service. It seems inappropriate to even smack it with a 10. It's a really deep injury to our clients and to the Muslim community in New York City and beyond. People are fearful of informants at mosques, and for good reason. People are fearful of newcomers at mosques, and for good reason. Religious leaders are afraid that their statements are going to be taken out of context by police officers, informants, or other congregants.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much, Ashley. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Scott. Have a good day.
You too. That's Ashley Gorski from the ACLU, wrongly legitimizing NYPD discrimination. ACLU.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. Man, it's too bad we ran out of time right there. I would have liked to let her. I guess she was pretty much done anyway, but I want people to really hear the human impact, like they say in the jargon. That ain't fair, man, that people got to be afraid to go to the mosque to practice their religion. That they got to be afraid every time a new person walks in the door claiming to be interested in joining their faith or joining their group. That every religious leader has to be afraid that, as she said, that anything he says will be misinterpreted as providing material support, this, that, or the other damn thing. And it's not like, oh, we can't figure out how to be fair about who's trying to suicide bomb us or not. The best we can do is just persecuting Muslims wherever they live in our country. And, you know, all the right-wing conspiracy crap about the, you know, Frank Gaffney-level neocon conspiracy crap, I should say, about, all the Muslims among us and how they all mean us harm and this and that. Before you believe that for a moment, just think about it for a moment. There are somewhere in approximately 3 to 5 million Muslims in America. If they were at war against this country, it would be burning. I'm not saying they would win, but I'm saying there would be major arson fires in every town right now, and there's not. All of the worst terrorist attacks since September 11th have been ridiculous FBI put-up jobs. And everybody knows it. Trevor Aronson heroically wrote a book about it, called The Terror Factory. You can read his work for Mother Jones as well. 50 cases of entrapment. 50 cases of, hey, stupid idiot, I'll give you $50,000 if you say you love Osama. You love Osama? You love Osama? Here's $50,000. Say you love Osama. Oh, wow, what a terrorism prosecution. We are all so terrified and impressed with your crime fighting. And I guess some of us are. Some of us not so much. And it's true, there was Faisal Shahzad, who is direct blowback from the terror war in Pakistan. He was not put up to it by the FBI, the Times Square attempted bomber. And Abdul Muttalib, I don't know how the hell he got on a plane to Detroit, man, but I don't think it was Americans who put him up to that either. That was Al-Qaeda in Yemen, guys. And I don't think it was, you know, Saudi double agents. People send me the headline in The Guardian. Oh, it was a CIA guy who did the underpants bomb. No, that's just sloppy headline writing. Read the actual article. They're not talking about Abdul Muttalib, the underpants bomber from Detroit. They're talking about the second failed attack that you forgot while you were focusing on the headline only. People send me that every time the story comes up. Guardian admitted it. He was CIA. No, read the article, not just the headline, please, before you email me about how wrong I am. Sorry, but still. Anyway, so there's Abdul Muttalib, and there's Faisal Shahzad, and then Zazi. I always forget his name, his first name. Najibullah Zazi, the cab driver from Denver. He was not put up to it by the U.S. government either. They busted his ass through, I forget exactly what police work, but that one wouldn't have put up job. All the rest of them, from the Moussaoui prosecution, or since the Moussaoui prosecution, not including, since the Moussaoui prosecution, all the rest of them just trumped up charges and or outright entrapment. This whole time. But anyway, your next door neighbor, the Muslim, has to be afraid when he goes to his mosque that somehow he's going to get wrapped up in some FBI scam, some persecution. That ain't right, man. This is America. Is it really that easy to get Americans to abandon what used to be the consensus? You know? On things like freedom of religion? I mean, basic freedom of association with your religious co-believers. We're going to get rid of that now, too? I don't know, man. That's no damn thing. All right. So now, listen. all day long on CNN, they've been talking about, oh, Samantha Power's at the UN, talking about sanctions against Russia. Let me say real quick, all day long they've been saying that Russia gave the Ukrainians this ultimatum that they got to get every last bit of their military out of the Crimean Peninsula or face a military storm. But they never really cited. They just say Russian state media. Oh, really? Who? And it was Isvenzetsia or whatever, the Ukrainian division. So it's a Ukrainian source saying that the Russians said this, and it's a private business. It's not Russian state media in the first place. So you're lying twice all day long. Russian ultimatum. Russian ultimatum. Let me tell you something. When these people are telling you things, they're lying to you about everything. They're liars. They're like the Russians, except worse. Except 1,000 times more violent.
Minorities.
This is Samantha Power, the humanitarian interventionist. Ambassador to the United Nations, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations right now.
Of international observers and monitors from the UN or OSCE to ensure that the people about whom Russia expresses such concern are protected from abuse and to elucidate for the world the facts on the ground. The solution to this crisis is not difficult to envision. There is a way out, and that is through direct and immediate dialogue by Russia with the government of Ukraine, the immediate pullback of Russia's military forces, the restoration of Ukraine's territorial integrity, and the urgent deployment of observers and human rights monitors, not through more threats and more distortions. Tonight, the OSCE will begin deploying
monitors
to Ukraine.
It's John Kerry, the Secretary of State, who is saying all options are on the table. And in fact, listen to what Kerry said to David Gregory on Meet the Press. David, the last thing anybody wants is a military option in this kind of situation. Hey, so far so good, right? We want a peaceful resolution through the normal processes of international relations. But in the absence of President Putin making the right decision to work with the government of Ukraine, to work with the West, to work with all of us, as I said a moment ago, this is not about Russia and the United States. Yeah, so he lets it go. He sort of changes his own subject. The last thing we want is a military option, but they better do what we say, announced the Secretary of State yesterday. And Samantha Power is saying, oh yeah, we'll have no more threats here. Yeah, threats aren't threats when it's the Americans making them, threatening to plunge the entire human species into near extinction.
And the United States will stand strongly and proudly with the people of Ukraine as they chart out their own destiny, their own government, their own future. The bottom line is that for all of the self-serving rhetoric we have heard from Russian officials in recent days, there is nothing that justifies Russian conduct. As I said in our last session, Russia's actions speak much louder than its words. What is happening today is not a human rights protection mission, and it is not a consensual intervention. What is happening today is a dangerous military intervention in Ukraine. It is an act of aggression. It must stop. This is a choice for Russia. Diplomacy can serve Russia's interests. The world is speaking out against the use of military threats and the use of force. Ukrainians must be allowed to determine their own destiny.
Now, look, I agree with that, the Russians should not have escalated their presence. I mean, they have a basing agreement, obviously. Khrushchev gave up Crimea to Ukrainian sovereignty back when, and that's the way of things. And I certainly do not mean to take Vladimir Putin's side. He's a horrible right-wing nationalist, just like the people who rule America. Just like Barack Obama. Right-wing nationalist, at least a wannabe imperialist. And I ain't like him. But my responsibility is opposing my government when it's wrong, which is always so. Just put your shoe on the other foot for one moment and you can see the madness here. If, for example, the Russians were financing neo-Nazi thugs on the streets of... what? What's the damn capital city of Canada anyway? Ottawa? If the Russians are supporting Nazi regime changers with SS lightning bolts, overthrowing the government of Canada, you know, in order to steer them away from us and make sure that their oil goes across the Bering Sea somehow, bypassing Alaska, I don't know, and going over the pole to Russia instead of coming down to Texas, just imagine what the American response would be. And don't tell me because we won the Cold War, we got the right to act this way. It's crazy. The Russians weren't messing with Crimea or messing with Ukraine till the Americans provoked them into doing it. I'm not saying it's the right thing that they did. I'm just saying, look who got us into this mess again. The damned Democrats. Just like everything. Talking about all options are on the table for dealing with the Russians, huh? Way to go, tough guy. You know what, John Kerry? I knew you were going to go down in history for something. Being the dumbest ass of the 21st century. Worse than George Bush when he invaded Iraq. Piece of crap. Can't believe these are the people who rule our nation and therefore the world. It's completely out of control. And by the way, you know, this thing, I admit it's from Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, which is basically the CIA, right? I don't know. But the reason that I quote it is because it's one of those things where even they... oh, I'm already at break, aren't I? Even they admit I'm right. I'll be right back with Brendan O'Neill to talk more about this after the break, y'all. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Live here on the Liberty Express, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, every weekday. My website is scotthorton.org. Keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. scotthorton.org. And our next guest is Brendan O'Neill from spikedonline.com. Two very important articles in question here. Ukraine, this isn't a revolution, it's regime change. And currently, it is the West, not Russia, that has behaved recklessly in Ukraine. Welcome back to the show. Brendan, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Scott.
Good. I appreciate you joining us today. So tell me about this Ukraine thing. I know you got a lot to say.
Yeah, I think the key problem at the moment is that we are just getting so much skewed reporting here in the West, which is giving a very distorted picture of what's happening. So we've been told that, for example, that this is a popular liberal revolution against a dictator that is being backed by Russia. But none of that adds up, because if you look at the uprising itself in Ukraine, it wasn't especially popular. It certainly wasn't very liberal, and we now know that there were far-right and even anti-Semitic elements amongst the protesters in Kiev. And far from ousting a dictator, in fact, the person it ousted, Viktor Yanukovych, was elected in a free and fair election in 2010 by around 13 million Ukrainians. So we have this really peculiar situation where the West is actually cheering the throwing out of an elected leader, and Russia, which is assumed to be undemocratic, is expressing concern about the ousting of that democratic leader. So the events on the ground are actually very topsy-turvy in comparison to what we're being told in the media.
Mm. Well, and what's great about it, if there's anything great about it, is the complete and total and obvious lack of dissonance in the mind of any of these hairdos, these so-called anchors and newsmen on TV talking about all this stuff. Nazis in the street with SS lightning bolts? Maybe I heard of that, but you know what? I'm just going to pretend I never heard of that. American intervention all over the place. Victoria Nuland caught on tape talking all about America's plans for the future, which just happened to be the guy that ended up becoming the new prime minister, and this kind of thing. You know what? Let's just pretend that history began on Saturday when the Russians started moving into Crimea. Why not?
I think, yeah, absolutely. And I think what it shows is that whenever there is a kind of a hint of the Cold War returning, everyone just kind of dumps their critical faculties. You know, both the right and also sections of the left are so desperate for a return of the Cold War, for a return of that kind of neat divide between West and East, that they are willing to sacrifice any kind of critical thinking. And so you now have a situation where, you know, Western politicians are normally extremely angsty about the rise of far-right groups in Eastern Europe. But in this instance, where we have a new interim government in Ukraine that has got anti-Semitic elements at the very top, in that instance, they're willing to turn a blind eye and even to celebrate that new government. You know, the left is normally quite critical of Western-fueled regime change in the Third World. But in this instance, where we have a very clear case of the European Union and Washington facilitating an undemocratic regime change, lots of the left are not being critical of that. So I think we can see how as soon as Russia is involved in something, as soon as there is a hint of, you know, this is a great battle between the good West and the bad East, people accept it too easily and they don't ask awkward questions. And I think there are a lot of awkward questions to ask about how Yanukovych was thrown out of power and how the new government was implemented in his place.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, and I want to ask you, though, before we get to all that, because I want to hear all what you got to say about that. But what do you think is behind all this other than just they hate Russians? Because I know that there are a lot of professional Russian haters and all the foreign policy establishments of the West, and they all need, you know, Exxon and Lockheed funding for their think tanks and that kind of thing. But is it just the pipelines? They want to cut Russia out of the pipelines, or is there anything more to it than that?
I think it actually speaks to a real immaturity amongst the Western diplomatic circles today, a kind of inability to see that the potential consequences their actions are going to have. And so I think a lot of the intervention in Ukraine was actually quite thoughtless. So when you had John McCain, for example, who actually went to the protest camps in Kiev and did this speech to them and said, yours is a just cause, you must keep on fighting against this evil regime. Or, you know, the German foreign minister also visited the camps and told them to keep on fighting. I think that was a really kind of thoughtless, almost self-defeating interventionism, because what it did is it bolstered the protesters. It made them think that they were the legitimate government of Ukraine, effectively. It isolated Yanukovych, and it tipped Ukraine over the edge into violence, effectively, by internationalizing a local conflict and intensifying a local conflict. And now we have European politicians and American politicians saying, oh my God, Ukraine is becoming this violent, unpredictable place, when in fact they did a huge amount to push it into that situation. So I think there's a great deal of idiocy in Western foreign policy circles today. And one thing I'm particularly concerned about in relation to Western foreign policy is how it now seems to be devoted so much to goading Russia, to kind of antagonizing Russia. You can see that through Ukraine. You could see it during the Georgia War in 2008, when America was very much on side with Georgian forces and was arming them and training them. You can see it in the way in which America has talked about building anti-missile radar systems in the Czech Republic, Poland, possibly Georgia, possibly Ukraine. There is this attempt by the West to kind of surround Russia with these hostile states and these hostile republics. And so if Russia feels paranoid and if Russia feels quite angry, it's not really surprising, because Western foreign policy is taking this extremely strange, weird kind of violence-stoking, anti-Russian approach.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I talked with Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, about this, and he said, come on, you know, for anyone who, you know, studies this kind of thing for a living for the U.S. government, they had to have known, or how could they not have known that this was a bridge too far, another one of these orange revolutions in Ukraine. The Russians canceled the coup last time. That's how Yanukovych was in the position to be overthrown this time again. And by that, I just mean they waited it out. They waited the American intervention out. Their guy ended up being reelected again. Now America's trying to do a coup again. But what do they think's going to happen? That Vladimir Putin's really just going to not do a thing? I keep mentioning this because I just can't get over it. They had the editor of Foreign Affairs went on the Colbert Report and was giggling about how, yeah, we had Putin so distracted with the Olympics that we're running off with Ukraine now. Like, come on, really? Is that what you think? He's going to cancel your big plans, doofus, you know?
It's crazy because I think, you know, in the past, foreign policy, the foreign policy establishment has always done terrible things. It's always launched terrible invasions and destabilized countries. But at least in the past, the Western foreign policy establishment had some understanding of history and some understanding of local tensions and the possible consequences of stirring those tensions up and making them worse. It had a policy of trying to contain conflict and pursue its interests in a rational manner. What we have today is an ahistorical, quite stupid, quite historically illiterate foreign policy establishment which doesn't think through the consequences of its actions. So they can, you know, they see protests in Ukraine and instead of saying, let's take a step back from this and see how the country deals with it, instead they all go there and they say to these protesters, which include far-right elements and anti-Semites, they say to them, yours is a just cause, keep on fighting, go harder, go further. And they don't think about the consequences that that will have inside Ukraine, in Crimea, and in Russia itself. So there's a real dangerous short-termism, you know, this desire to look big and important on the world stage by seeming to support democratic uprising without thinking about whether that uprising is really democratic and what the consequences might be of stoking it up.
Well, and now at this point, the Russians have gone in and canceled the coup, at least as far as Crimea goes, with actual boots on the ground, which is what really counts, of course. And the question for now is, you know, whether, I guess, you know, whether you think the West will provoke it or not, one way or the other, whether the Russians are going to go further and maybe break off eastern Ukraine. What do you think of the chances of that? Oh, and by the way, you have very little time to answer that question.
I think that may well happen, but I think Russia is fundamentally a status quo power. It wants to maintain the status quo, whereas the West is becoming an extremely reckless, risky actor, and that's the real tension. The West doesn't think through what it does, and Russia is just pretty keen to fortify its borders and keep things as they are.
All right. Hold on right there, everybody. It's Brendan O'Neill from SpikedOnline.com. We're talking about American and Western intervention in Ukraine and the blowback, which came quick. And we'll be right back after this. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the line with Brendan O'Neill from SpikedOnline.com. And we're talking about American and European intervention in Ukraine. And you know what, just for argument's sake, Brendan, I was wondering, would you help me go through the evidences of American and Western intervention leading to not just the blowback from the Russians, but leading up to Yanukovych fleeing town and all of that. And then I want to talk about the various right-wing nationalists involved and even neo-Nazis and so forth. But apparently, it's funny, you know, for anybody paying attention, this is just, yeah, okay, well, I saw the whole thing happen in front of my eyes. But then all of a sudden, you realize that you know, they're denying that the Americans had anything to do with this, at least with their silence. They're denying that anything happened before Saturday over there that any Americans need to know about. So we had, first of all, of course, there's the leaked video. I don't know leaked by who, but there's video of Victoria Nuland talking about funneling $5 billion into Ukraine over, I'm not exactly certain what period of time. But then also there's her conversation that was leaked, plotting who should take over next. Just happens to be the people who are taking over right now. And then, of course, you know, as you mentioned, going over there, Nuland and McCain both going over there and egging the protesters on, et cetera, like that. But what else do you know? NED, USAID, CIA, or oh, of course, there was the thing. One more thing. In Der Spiegel, they talked about how these billionaires got some phone calls about how, hey, if you don't want sanctions on your money that's sitting in accounts outside of the country, it's time for you to give up support for Yanukovych. And that was what, you know, took the power out from beneath him and his own party of regents, and led to, you know, like Nixon's own Republicans kicking him out of D.C. kind of a thing there.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting, there's a real double standard in the language. So whenever Russia does anything in relation to Ukraine, it's referred to as meddling, you know, an unacceptable attack on Ukrainian sovereignty. But whenever a Western government does something, it's called mediation. It's called democracy talks. It's called trying to rescue Ukraine rather than interfere in Ukraine. So there's a real double standard, which means lots of people are confused who is meddling in this country and who has been meddling in it over the past 3 months. The way I see it is that the protests themselves were triggered by a kind of standoff between the EU and Russia over the future of Ukraine, where the EU was saying to Ukraine, you must sign up to this new trade deal, you must agree to reform, you must do as we tell you in Brussels. And then the Ukrainian leader decided to go with Russia instead of with the EU, and that gave rise to the protests. And then what happens after the protests start is that lots of Western politicians start to intervene very explicitly in Ukrainian affairs, firstly by visiting the camps and telling them to carry on fighting, which to my mind is a severe interference in other states' affairs. They also started to have high-level talks with representatives of the protesters. So, for example, Angela Merkel in Germany had talks with some of the leaders of the opposition, talks about how they could set up a new government. And it's in the same week that she does that that the violence flared up, a couple of weeks ago when there was some serious violence in Kiev. It's exactly at that moment, because what Yanukovych recognizes is that his time is up. He has been completely delegitimized by a Western campaign of demonization where everyone treats him as a dictator, and his successors have effectively been picked by Merkel, by John Kerry, by others in the West who said, you will be the next government, to all these various oppositional forces. So it's all that form of intervention, that kind of underhand intervention and that explicit goading of the protesters, which isolated Yanukovych and left him with effectively with little choice but to try to assert his authority. And he tried to assert his authority with violence. And so I think at every stage, from the start of the protest to the inflaming of the protest to the descent into actual violence on the streets, it was all exacerbated by explicit Western intervention to determine the future of Ukraine.
Yeah, but Yanukovych was a terrible guy. I saw it on TV. Very terrible.
I must say, I'm no fan of Yanukovych, and I'm sure he's an unpleasant politician, as lots of politicians in Europe are. But the fact is that he was elected in a free and fair election in 2010. He got around 13 million of people's votes. And then that was in the presidential elections in 2010. And then in the parliamentary elections in 2012, his party also got the highest number of votes. So this is a situation where a politician who and his party, who have been elected pretty convincingly twice over the past 4 years, have now been pushed aside by a section of the Ukrainian population, not a majority by any stretch of the imagination, a section of the Ukrainian population cheered on by Washington and Brussels. So the next time Washington or Brussels talk about the lack of democracy in the third world or tyrannical movements in the third world that override people's democratic rights, I think we should laugh in their face because they have just spent the past 3 months conniving with the ousting of a democratically elected leader. And in the process, they have set an extraordinarily dangerous precedent where now everyone in Eastern Europe and elsewhere knows that if they take to the streets and stay on the streets and kick up a fuss, they can override the democratic will of their own nation by getting the West on their side and getting the West to help them get rid of a leader that they don't like. It's a really dangerous, undemocratic precedent that has been set here by Washington and Brussels.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sitting here talking with a dead mic. They bided their time, the Russians, after 2004. But now, doing the same kind of scam again here, the Westerners have escalated the level of pushback from the Russians. So that's a brand new precedent set, too. Maybe they'll see fit to cancel America's will in Estonia or Latvia next time. And then what are we going to do about that? But we're the ones who we're the ones who escalated it to this point.
Absolutely. And what I think is remarkable about the events recently is actually that Russia took a step back, certainly over the past 3 months while the protests were taking place and while they were being stirred up by Western politicians. Russia actually stood back and observed events. And that is why Yanukovych was relatively easily thrown out of power, because he didn't actually have, you know, the massive military backing of evil Russia, as lots of the Western media reports would have us believe. So I think what's happening now is that Russia is fairly desperately trying to fortify its own borders. It shares a very long border with Ukraine. It's trying to protect its interests in Crimea, which historically has been an extremely important place for Russia. And it's responding to what it sees as provocation and pressure from the West. So I would say that the image that we are given, which is that Russia is the aggressor here, Russia is the expansionist empire, Russia is trying to conquer Europe, and the West is trying to hold it back, is actually the opposite of the truth. What's happening is that the West is venturing further east, is trying to determine the fates of all these eastern countries, and it's Russia that's trying its best to hold that back. So I think we are being given the polar opposite of what's happening on the ground.
Yeah, pretty much with everything these people say. Well, certainly in America. I know that's your experience in the UK, too. And here's the other thing. You know, you talk about, next time the precedent set and all of that. That's if there is a next time. I got the Secretary of State on TV talking about all options are on the table. They're so used to threatening the nuke-less Iranians that way that John Kerry is talking about that. Talking that way about the Russians, and even he said, well, nobody wants to see a military option, but Russia better start doing the right thing. Wait, what? And said, all options has meant even, historically speaking, that means including nuclear first strikes. I mean, that's all options is including nuke first strikes. Who are these people, and how did I get stuck in this dimension with them where everything is wrong?
It's extraordinary, and to think that this has come about over 3 months, effectively. 3 months ago, you had the start of some protests in Ukraine by a few angry, largely middle-class urbanites in Kiev, and 3 months down the line, it's become this huge standoff between Washington and Moscow, and I think that speaks to the way in which Western foreign policy is now so out of control. It is so unanchored. It is so kind of reckless, and you have a situation where it just takes all these actions, it ousts governments and replaces them with friendly governments that it handpicked, and it just doesn't sit down, take a breath, and think to itself, is this a wise thing to do? Is this going to increase global stability, or is it going to make things more unstable? And so we now have a situation where, as you say, America is posturing against Russia in a very warlike fashion. Russia is expressing extreme anger with Merkel and Washington. And you have this huge global tension brought about by a handful of protesters in Ukraine who were then backed foolishly by the West. It's crazy that we've got to this situation in such a short period of time.
Yeah, and I wasn't able to see all of it, but Samantha Power, the UN ambassador, gave a talk there, and the crawl at the bottom of the page was new sanctions against Russia. I mean, this is just such bad news. There's no reason in the world it has to be this way except for these numbskulls in charge here.
Well, Samantha Power is a good example of the new foreign policy establishment I'm talking about, because what you have in Samantha Power is just a historically illiterate moral poser who thinks that the international stage is basically a platform from which she can make grand speeches and seem like a purposeful individual.
Yeah.
That's what the foreign policy establishment in the West is now made up of. These very infantile people who don't know their history, who don't understand politics, who don't understand how international affairs work. So they think nothing of taking to a lectern and making bombastic speeches about what they see as evil foreign countries. They don't think through consequences. They don't think through what their behavior is going to result in. And we know that Samantha Power really pressured Obama to take action in Libya, and that ended absolutely disastrously for the Libyan people and for America.
And for her personal reasons, as reported by Michael Hastings, too, just like you said. I'm sorry, we got to go raw time. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it, Brendan.
Cool. Thanks, Scott.
That's the great Brendan O'Neill, everybody. SpikedOnline.com. We'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Okay, welcome back, y'all. It's the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And yeah, man, Samantha Power, I wish Michael Hastings was still alive and reporting stuff. Michael Hastings did a report about Libya, about how Barack Obama came to decide to wage war in Libya in 2011. And part of that story was that Samantha Power, the current UN ambassador, the current ambassador to the UN, she had been brought onto the Obama team early, but had made an enemy out of Hillary Clinton in the primaries, called her a monster. Remember that? Samantha Power calls Hillary Clinton a monster. Well, yeah, but who are you? She's a hell of a lot more powerful than you. She got the job as Secretary of Monster, running the State Department. Monster of State, I guess, would have been better. And so Samantha Power had to be exiled inside the government. She still got a job, but she wasn't going to be anywhere near Hillary. Hillary had exiled her to Deputy Assistant Secretary of Lying About Crap or whatever at the National Security Council. So she had a White House job, but way down on the level and not in charge. So they had the quote that her job was like teaching Iraqis about democracy and other, here's the quote, do-gooder rinky-dink stuff. Teaching Iraqis about democracy. Thought we killed 1 million people so they could have a democracy. That's do-gooder rinky-dink stuff, huh? And of course, that's her reputation. She's the do-gooder of the decade, right? She's Miss Do-Gooder. And anyway, she decided she could get the president's attention and maybe a promotion if she were to get America into a war. And so she made an alliance first with Susan Rice, and then they took the case to Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton agreed, just like I speculated at the time. But of course, I know, because I know everything. Hillary decided to support the regime change in Libya just to try to confuse the issue. when the fact was America backs every single dictator in the region other than the Ayatollah and the and Assad in Syria. The rest of them belong to America. And after the people of Egypt overthrew Mubarak, America looked really bad, and it was starting to become very obvious, even to Americans, that, wow, Uncle Sam backs all the bad guys, all the kings, all the sultans, all the generals, all the murderers of the Middle East work for Uncle Sam, illegitimate rulers, each and every one of them. I mean, and that's if you accept popular sovereignty as a theory and all that. Nothing like legitimacy. America's the bad guy. Everyone could tell. Even CNN couldn't help but admit that, hey, Hillary Clinton says that Mubarak is her family friend. She hates to see him go. It's the last thing in the world she wants is for the dictatorship in Egypt to fall. Well, then they realize that's really bad PR. So we could invade Libya, take a stand against Gaddafi, who Bush had brought back in from the cold in 2003 because he needed to try to pretend that the Iraq war scared Gaddafi into doing what they wanted him to do, which was a lie. He'd been begging to come back in from the cold since 96, and all he did was buy a bunch of nuclear junk at AQ Khan's garage sale, leave it in its boxes and everything, and just he only bought it so he could give it up and say, here, I'll give you some nuke centrifuge parts if you'll just bring me back in and we can do some business. But still, he was no Mubarak, he was no family friend, so he was expendable to Hillary Clinton. And they said, well, we can take the side of the people, i.e. the Mujahideen, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and Ansar al-Sharia, etc., and we'll take their side against Colonel Gaddafi, whose one virtue in the world is that he's good at keeping al-Qaeda down. And so they supported that war. But Samantha Power's entire role in the process was she wanted some attention from the president. She was tired of being the deputy under secretary of do-gooder rinky-dink stuff. And she wanted for him to look at her and say her name and pat her on the head and let her have a war. And that was a major part of how America's intervention in Libya was waged. And exactly like Brendan O'Neill says, looking not even as far away as their own fingertips into the future for what this is going to mean after they get away with looking big for a day in front of the cameras. It's the same thing going on with the Sunni-Shia civil war and the entire Arab world that America's engendered here. I mean, you could say the whole thing's a brilliant, non-planned thing, but I think that's basically mostly just by default. I think America's best policy is simply, the sorcerer's apprentice, making everything worse and worse and worse and worse the more he tries to fix it. Bull in a china shop and all of that. It's crazy.
I don't know. There's so many different things. Let me talk about this. This is important.
I am giving the opening introduction-y thing this Friday in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club. If you believe that. It's the National Summit to Reassess the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship. And I'll be introducing the whole thing. And then I will be moderating one of the panels. But this thing is 8 to 5 all day long at the National Press Club on Friday. I think it's already going to be a packed house, but do show up if you can. And you may have heard the commercial earlier on the show. Phil Giraldi is going to have a whole panel of former CIA guys, including Michael Scheuer and Ray McGovern, and I forget who else. They've got also a former FBI guy to talk about, investigations, what could have been. There's military guys to talk about the costs of American support for Israel, and then there's all kinds of other activists and writers, Philip Weiss from Mondo Weiss, Justin Raimondo from Antiwar.com, Scott McConnell from the American Conservative Magazine, and Grant F. Smith, of course, from the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, Stephen Walt, professor at Harvard and author of The Israel Lobby and American Foreign Policy, and all-star thing, Karen Kotowski, a former lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force, retired there, and yeah.
So that's a hell of a thing. And I'm giving the welcome to the thing talk at the beginning. Holy crap. Man, I don't know, dude. Gulp. I guess I better get used to the idea. I'm terrified. Okay. Well, at least I can admit it. We'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes. Hey, you know what's really bothering me? This is all Barack Obama's fault. He can fix this. He's the freaking most powerful man in the world. And I know he's just a figurehead, but he's still the most powerful man in the world. And it doesn't have to be this way, the way he does things. And especially, you know, all of this foreign policy stuff is tied together. Except China seems pretty much on the periphery of all of our Middle Eastern and European crap. They don't really have anything to do with it. But the rest of this is all tied together. And right now, you know, I don't want to really get this wrong. The truth is the Iranians have been willing to deal since 2003, since really even the 1990s. They've been willing to deal in an open and honest way, and the Americans have refused to take them up on it. But right now, in the midst of the Iran talks, not to give the Russians credit for making the Iranians go along or anything like that, because I don't think that's really right, but it certainly would be nice if the UN Security Council could all maintain friendly relations with each other as they and their ally, Germany, the P5 plus one, the permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany, meet with the Iranians and try to negotiate a nuclear deal that will be satisfactory mostly to the US and I guess to the UK as auxiliaries for Israel. The deal is going to be that you can enrich uranium, just please keep it under 5%, and please limit the expansion of your centrifuges, and please sign the additional protocol and subsidiary arrangements, or agreements, to the safeguards agreement with the IAEA, and answer a lot of questions about Israeli forged laptop documents, and maybe let us look at your centrifuge-making facilities, which don't technically fall under the safeguards agreement, and, you know, stuff like that. Turn COM into a research facility if possible. If they could satisfy all of those things, then the American argument, which never did have a leg to stand on, would very apparently not have a leg to stand on anymore in their aggressive stance toward Iran, which is what Obama's going for here. He's trying to, you know, get rid of this gigantic, outstanding problem that they have a nuclear program that the West has so far opposed and refused to sanctify, and we gotta end that as an issue between our state and theirs. Why pick a fight with the Russians now? Now, if you're Robert Perry at Consortium News, then you just love Obama so much you assume that it ain't his fault, even though it really is. But I think there may be at least a kernel of truth to Perry's idea that Victoria Nuland, who is in fact the wife of Robert Kagan, who is the lick spittle of William Kristol and co-author of Torah Neo-Reaganite Foreign Policy in 1996, all about how we must install a world empire of benevolent global hegemony. You know, all that takeover stuff, that maybe, and one of the primary liars who lied us into war from the pages of the Washington Post back in 2002 and 3, getting us into the Iraq War, and steady proponent of every kind of horrible intervention. In fact, author of books apologizing for the empire and saying this is not the era of decline. We still rule and we always will. Obama was photographed with the book back when him and Romney both had Robert Kagan's book about the greatness of American empire back during the last election in 2012. And anyway, so, but Perry's idea is that this whole problem with Ukraine is mostly trumped up by the neocons just to sabotage the Iran talks. That may be the biggest motivation of all. Why not? It's not like it's brilliantly Machiavellian, it's just ho-hum Machiavellian. What outstanding issue do we have with the Russians other than Syria, where Putin played those cards perfectly, saved Obama from launching a war the American people did not want him to launch by giving him an out on the chemical weapons? What other problem can we trump up between America and Syria? I mean, between America and Russia, before this Iran deal is finalized in the coming, in April, really, right? In 8 weeks from now. How about Ukraine? Let's make a mess out of that. I think that's probably a minor part of it. I don't really see it the way Perry does in the size of the role it played, but it certainly is one major negative consequence of this thing, isn't it? That maybe going into these talks, instead of everybody's all chums, hell, assuming we all live till these talks 8 weeks from now, instead of them all being buddies going in there, all laughing around the table like last time, this is going to be a major problem between the members of the UN Security Council, who before were a united front.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state, available at scotthorton.org/Amazon.
All right, guys, so welcome back to The Thing here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Thanks for tuning in. Now, Jeffrey Goldberg, who's a noted right-wing hawk slash journalist, now writing for Bloomberg.com, has gotten another interview with Barack Obama. It says an hour-long interview in the Oval Office. Obama to Israel. Time is running out. I'm trying to imagine the scene here. Interesting. When Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visits the White House tomorrow, Goldberg writes, President Barack Obama will tell him that his country could face a bleak future, one of international isolation and demographic disaster, if he refuses to endorse a U.S.-drafted framework agreement for peace with the Palestinians. Obama will warn Netanyahu that time is running out for Israel as a Jewish-majority democracy, and the president will make the case that Netanyahu, alone among Israelis, has the strength and political credibility to lead his people away from the precipice. Isn't that something? Now, geez, wow. So Obama's told that to Jeffrey Goldberg's face, that this is what I'm going to tell Netanyahu. And when is this happening again? That's a pretty serious deal. And listen, I think that I'm the first to say, or I don't know, I ain't the best one to make the case or anything, but I'm first to say that Obama's completely blown it. I never understood this. If you listen to me since back in the day, then you know, ever since Obama came to power, I never understood why he made such a big deal about Palestine when he wasn't willing to threaten to withhold aid to Israel, when he wasn't willing to threaten to withhold vetoes on the UN Security Council about their occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. And if he's not willing to make them do the right thing, then what does he think that Netanyahu is going to do? Whatever is the right thing? Snap out of it, Mr. President. Come on, man. So now here he is. He brings it up again. I think Andrew Coburn scared the hell out of me, but sounded right to me that Obama doesn't want to see this happen if John Kerry's going to get the credit because he's that kind of petty SOB. I'd buy that. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's important enough. Maybe Obama thinks he can get to share the credit with Kerry. And come on, man. Isn't this the history of the world you guys are writing here? Isn't anything more important than your legacy, not being relegated to do good or rinky-dink stuff, but getting important things done? Even if you got to share a little bit of the credit, isn't it okay to go ahead and, even if you don't get any of the credit, what if you're William Burns negotiating the Iran nuclear deal in secret in Oman? Isn't that the right thing to do anyway? I guess they leaked it to Laura Rosen. He gets his credit, but not mostly. Kerry gets the credit as far as the public's concerned, right? Anyway, I don't know what it is about Benjamin Netanyahu's skull, other than maybe how thick it is, that he doesn't get this, because this is just a fact. That non-Jewish Arabs, Christian and Muslim, will outnumber the Jews under the Israeli government. Soon. The demographic bomb. Oh, they're so dirty and scary, those Muslim Arabs and Christian Arabs. And so the deal is either cut them loose, give them the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and let them have their own state,
or you're going to have an outright apartheid that is, you know, completely basically banished from global polite society like they're trying to do with Russia right now. And or they'll have to become a one-party state with an Arab majority, which, Mr., you must recognize Israel, not just the borders, but as a Jewish state in order for us to even consider giving you the rump of a pretend sort of state with no state powers in Palestine kind of argument. What do you think he wants to do? For some reason, these Likudniks think the status quo is the right answer? What, are they crazy? And what my fear is, it seems like the obvious thing if you just think it out, you know? If they're determined, if the Likudniks, if Netanyahu and his allies, and there are a lot of people with a lot of power to the right of him and his coalition, if they're so certain and they're so hell-bent on keeping the West Bank and East Jerusalem for all time, then at some point they're going to have to go Andrew Jackson and force march all the people, all the Palestinians of the Gaza Strip somewhere. Into the Jordan River? Or, I don't know, up into Syria somehow? Or just, you know, banish them to one tiny little segment of the West Bank? In, you know, a little, you know, half a Gaza-sized concentration camp somewhere and take the rest? I don't know what their plan is, but none of it makes any sense. When Obama tells Goldberg that this is what he's going to tell Netanyahu, he's making perfect sense. And I don't know exactly about all the specifics of stupid John Kerry's plan. But the bottom line, give up the West Bank or else eventually be ruled over a Palestinian Arab majority sooner or later kind of a thing. If that ain't the answer, if that isn't the truth of the matter, I don't know what is. And yeah, I do know what is. It's that. And so what's Netanyahu going to do here? He's going to come to the AIPAC convention, and he's going to try to rally all the American people against the American president, trying to tell Israel the blatant truth about their own even short-term future, medium-term future. Let's see, you can commit national suicide, or you can start acting right at all. Are you that insistent on doing the wrong thing that you destroy your own project, which I'm not... At this point, well, I don't really have a dog in the fight, so I don't know, man. I don't really care. But more and more, I guess I thought that the two-state thing made more sense, all things considered. But Max Blumenthal, I think, has convinced me that no, it has to be a one-party state or a no-party state or something over there. Other than a two-state solution, because it's just too late for that. And if you haven't read Goliath, well, then you're half like me. I've read about half of it, and then I can't seem to get around to finishing that thing, but I got to. It's really good. I'm just terrible about reading books these days. Facebook destroyed my brain, I think. Facebook and damn Twitter. God dang. I used to read books, I swear. If you saw my pile of books that I want to read, that I've bought and that I've had sent to me, that I haven't read yet, you'd be laughing and pointing and shaking your head. What the hell are you going to do, Horton, with all those books? I don't know. I mean, I read a lot of them too, but a lot of them I didn't. Anyway, Netanyahu's going to come here and he's going to try to rally everybody against the president, certainly the political right. And, of course, he's going to try to get them to ruin the Iran deal, too. Jeez, guys. It's like you write your stupid policy just to give me remarks to say at the thing this Friday. You make it so easy. Boy, I better start getting prepared. I got delayed by weather, and I showed up late to that FFF speech. And, oh, my God. Every time I think back about that FFF speech, all I can think of is the errors I made in it. Mostly just putting things in the wrong order and not saying the very important thing that I meant to say. There were about five of those or something. It's just, I don't know. I mean, everybody there liked it. Eventually the video will come out, I don't know. But I don't want to have that happen again. And this is a scary one, man. I'm the original, I'm the
not the whole time or anything, but I'm at least the morning kind of welcome to the thing here, MC of the thing. That's pretty scary, isn't it? Don't know. Oh, someone in the chat room is asking me about the Pando, the Mark Ames smear of Greenwald. I'm not impressed. I read Greenwald and Wheeler's responses. Mark Ames is a joke, dude. I don't take anything he says seriously. Can't even get his facts straight, much less his opinions, right? And I'm sure Pierre Omidyar... Well, I'll sum it up like this. Glenn Greenwald said, I don't know anything about the family that owns Salon.com. Never came up. All I did was my work. Same difference with this Omidyar guy. And, you know, in fact, if you read Greenwald and you read Marcy Wheeler, all he did was give his money to one of these things that gives money to a bunch of different things. And then one of the things that they gave money to was this Ukrainian whatever. Hardly means he was acting, you know, deputized by the CIA to engineer a regime change over there. Although he was, and his money was part of, I think, what was ultimately a CIA, NED, or USAID type regime change operation there, but I wouldn't put Omidyar at the center of it. Certainly Ames falls far short of showing that. And then why that means that every journalist at first look should have to, you know, explain themselves or whatever, I think is completely ridiculous. And I think Glenn Greenwald's work for Salon.com, which I don't know what family owns Salon.com either, but oh no, how compromised he was all those years that he wrote all that great stuff there. And, you know, I'm sure there's a bunch of scum that run The Guardian too, but that never seemed to be a problem for him when he was working there. So, and I believe that Greenwald, if he felt like he was compromised by this Omidyar guy, he would just go back to his own blog. He's got six of them or something, you know what I mean? Over at the, unclaimed territory and his all his side document blogs and whatever. He doesn't need Omidyar to publish. He just got a pretty good deal out of it. And I think one that's getting better. And anyway, and I'm really looking forward to Matt Taibbi having his own project. Matt Taibbi is not going to be part of the Greenwald project. He's having his own thing spun off here. And so, you know what? Even if that guy Omidyar is double as bad as George Soros, good. Loot him for every penny you can get out of him and spend it doing kick-ass journalism against people just like him. Or against him or not or whatever. You know? I don't know. I'm not really buying it. And I'm biased toward Greenwald. But I don't know. Ames, ever since Obama got into office, Ames decided that power isn't the problem. Anybody who opposes power is the problem. And he's tried to smear every kind of libertarian and Greenwald ever since this Greenwald-Snowden stuff came out over and over again. I don't think he's hit his mark yet. Anyway, he used to kind of like that guy. Whatever, man. Okay, thanks y'all for listening. Sorry, I didn't get to talk about the Iran nuke stuff as much as I want. I had some stuff for you there. Oh, and the military spending. But anyway, see you tomorrow on the show. Back here, Liberty Express.